someone who likes the money they're offering, I would imagine. You know, if it's a chance to be a Premier League striker for 6 months, why would you not do it?
But the point being is there will be better clubs out there for anybody who's any good. With the greatest respect.
Are there more? I don't know. Well, that's an interesting question. You know, are there more clubs than there are players who would like to play for? No, I think there's probably an endless supply of footballers. I think Southampton could probably. The problem with strikers is they cost money. They cost a lot of money. But by January, you might find that someone out of favour a little bit further up the league. Mm. There might be a player who's been winning the Championship. Well, I don't know who'll be out of favour at other Premier League teams in January. I'm not a clairvoyant. I'm just saying that it's entirely possible that you might have a player who is available to Southampton in January who maybe would not have been available to them in the summer. Mm.
That was a striker just FaceTiming Rory to say, could you let Southampton know that I might be available?
Everything's on Do Not Disturb. I'm not quite sure who that was. very interesting. I do apologise.
Do you, when you look at Ipswich, who obviously had Liverpool and City first, but they picked up points, as Chris said, Andros, in their last three games. Now, they averaged the least possession at the moment in the Premier League so far this season. Do you sort of applaud them for actually being quite pragmatic so far in their start to the Premier League season?
I think they've been pragmatic in terms of keeping possession and how much possession they've had, but out of possession, they're quite aggressive in the way they like to press. They like to commit men forward. So, yeah, I applaud them for coming up from the Championship and being fearless in, like I said, out of possession, the way they commit men forward. Even in possession, they may not have possession, but when they do, they get a lot of bodies on the final third. And I'll go back to Luton last season. We didn't have that belief for a good few months, and Ipswich are so far ahead of where we were last season because they have come up with that no fear. They've stuck to their beliefs, and it's only a matter of time before those players, a lot of those haven't played Premier League football before they get the confidence, they have that feeling of, right, we are good enough. These superior players we've watched on TV, they are only players and we are good enough to be here. And I'm sure you'll see the possession gradually get more and more as the season goes on.
And just a quick one on Leicester before we go to the news, and then Ian Graham is going to join us. He played such a crucial part in Liverpool's transfer policy over many, many years, and he's got a book out. It's all to do with data revolution, so we'll talk to him about that. He's joining us live in just a moment. Just on Leicester, Chris, do you think their greatest, I don't know what the right word is, challenge or threat or issue is actually expectation? I don't think they're viewed as much as a promoted club as the other two, if you see what I mean.
I would have thought the expectation, I know what you mean, but I think that, I don't know, I think we would all pretty much think the same thing. A promoted side, whoever they are, coming straight back up, the expectation is, if we can stay in the Premier League by any means, then they'd take that up. I mean, you know, they got thoroughly played off the park in the first game against Tottenham. I actually thought from what I saw at the weekend, Everton probably should have won the game. I think Steve Cooper has got a really difficult job on. He's obviously taken over from Maresca. He's brought in a number of players in the transfer window. Oliver Skip, Jordan Ayew has come in, and he's probably still, like I suppose Ipswich as well, who brought in a fair few in Southampton, still striving to find out what his best first 11 is, and that's the challenge. But all these teams, you know, then managers, they're under pressure to find out and find out quickly, because the sooner they get the first win under the belt, then the better.
Chris Sutton, Andros Townsend and Rory Smith are on the Monday Night Club this evening. If you missed any of the first hour, you can watch it again on the iPlayer, listen again on Sounds, and a shortened version of the Monday Night Club is available as part of the Football Daily Podcast a little bit later on. We will talk live to Ian Graham. He was Liverpool's first director of research. That was the official title. He's got a new book out, and we will talk to him after the latest news with Jill McKenzie.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Lebanon says Israeli airstrikes have now killed at least 350 people and more than 1,200 have been hurt. It's the deadliest day of conflict across Israel's northern border in nearly two decades. In response, the US says it's sending a small number of extra troops to the Middle East. The Chancellor's promised Britain's best days lie ahead as she tried to strike a more optimistic tone in her first speech to the Labour Party conference as Chancellor. Rachel Reeves has been accused of talking the economy down. She's warned of tough choices to deal with the economic inheritance from the Conservatives. Nurses in England have rejected the government's award of a 5.5% pay rise for this financial year. The Royal College of Nursing said two-thirds voted against the deal, with turnout at a record high. Harrods has started an internal review looking at whether current staff were involved in any of the allegations relating to Mohamed Al-Fayed. A former employee has told BBC News a manager didn't investigate after she made allegations of inappropriate behaviour. The BBC understands that manager still works at Harrods. And from tomorrow, the UK's biggest building society says new borrowers can request a mortgage up to six times their income with a 5% deposit. The Nationwide is trying to lure in first-time buyers, but it'll only be available for people taking out a 5 or 10 year fixed-rate deal.
On Radio 4, the more you listen, the more you see.
We're living under more tyranny today than our founding fathers did in 1775.
A US presidential election is looming, but underneath, conspiracy culture rears its head once again, and nothing is as it seems.
All those things that we had feared our whole lives was coming true.
Burn the house down and start over. That seems to be the way.
It's America through the looking glass. Join me, Gabriel Gatehouse, as the coming storm continues. Listen on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
This is Five Live Sports.
The Monday Night Club with Mark Chapman.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
And in the next hour of the Monday Night Club, we'll chat Nicholas Jackson, who's had a very good start to the season at Chelsea. The latest on the Everton takeover and also Andros's first few weeks in Turkey. Now he's actually able to play football. And then at 9 o'clock, Five Live Boxing, Steve Bunce and Mike Costello will be with us to look back at the stunning victory of Daniel Dubois over Anthony Joshua at Wembley on Saturday night. So MNC at bbc.co.uk to get in touch. 85058 at Five Live Sport, and you can watch us on the iPlayer or the BBC Sport website, and you can listen on BBC Sounds as well as on Five Live. Next 15 minutes, 20 minutes or so, we're joined by Ian Graham, author of the new book, How to Win the Premier League, The Inside Story of Football's Data Revolution, who was at Liverpool for 11 seasons as Director of Research. He joins us now. Evening, Ian, how are you?
Very well, thanks. I've torn myself away from the Fleetwood game to talk to you for the first 15 minutes
in that game. And how is the Fleetwood game going? I haven't got that on the screen in this studio tonight, annoyingly.
Nothing much to report on so far.
Do you watch that as a football fan, or are you watching that with a data head on, a data model head on, or are you just relaxing?
A little bit of both. I'm working with clubs at different levels now, so it's quite interesting to see how the game changes. What works in the Premier League doesn't always work in League One or League Two. So watch it with a bit of professional interest, but also as a fan. Typically when I watch a game live, I just watch it as a fan. I get as emotionally involved as the rest of us. And it's only after the fact I go back and look at the data.
So actually, when you're talking about, and one of the things I am fascinated in, and from having read several articles on the book and so on and so forth, is how models have changed over, say, even the last decade of you being involved at Liverpool. But the models now are so sophisticated that different models can work at different levels of leagues, can they?
In principle, I think we're not there yet. But the quality of data is such that you can sort of look at different skill levels. We sort of assume that Premier League players are more skilled than League Two players. That's one reason they're playing in the Premier League, not in League Two. And the quality of data you get is 25 frames a second. You can see where all of the players are. And so things like which passing lanes are available, how long does it take you to get the ball under control, and then make that pass. As the skill levels go up, you need less space and less time to pick a good pass. But at the lower levels, maybe a pass that a Kevin De Bruyne or a Steven Gerrard could make than your sort of average League Two player at Fleetwood, that path might not be on for them.
When you first started at Liverpool to when you finished, how did the battle to get data and models accepted change over that time? When you started, was it difficult?
Yeah, it was difficult. Data was a new thing in football. So in English football in the 1970s, data was credited with like the invention of the long ball game that led to England not qualifying for the World Cup in 74 and 78, as you can read about in my book and in Rory's book as well. But really, that data was hand-collected, so it wasn't widely available. It was only in the mid-2000s that any sort of data about players that made any sort of sense became available. And so it was a really new thing. Football is quite a conservative industry, so you can understand why it took a while to get adopted. And when I started at Liverpool, Brendan Rodgers was the manager. I think we arrived, you know, within a week of each other. And his concept was the kind of traditional manager decides all signings concept. He couldn't really understand, you know, why you'd want to do data analysis. He'd seen a player that's played well. Let's just sign that player. The idea behind data analysis is you can look at thousands of players that you just don't have time. You just don't have time to look at. And so those early days, it was a big culture clash because of that. We were unproven as well. You know, we hadn't signed any good players using data. So really the change came with the arrival of Jurgen Klopp.
And I think it's quite important to say, because first of all, thank you for mentioning Rory's book, because he has been bristling that we're interviewing you and giving, you know, no, giving a big platform to your book.
I read Ian's book before it came out, and it's really annoying, because the one thing I thought was, like, he's a physicist, it'll be really smart, but it won't be that engaging. And it's really funny, and it irritated me beyond belief that he had the nerve to be funny in writing.
Oh, yeah. Well, Chris, every now and then will hold up a copy of Rory's book on the iPlayer just to keep him happy. One of the interesting points, though, Ian, in all of this, and from what you have said, and as again, the stuff that I've read is, you are very, everything has to complement each other. It isn't just data, is it? And we had David Pleat on last week, who was talking about the older school way of doing things and putting the miles in and watching the players and getting to know their characteristics and their personalities. It all has to fit together. It's not, here's all the data, this is why you should sign him, go and sign him. There has to be more to it.
Yeah, absolutely. So my old boss, Michael Edwards, was the sporting director at Liverpool, and he always said, if traditional scouting and if data agree on a player, then that player rarely fails. The only ones that failed for us, when everyone was in agreement, was players who had bad injury problems. I think, you know, the manager has to have a really important input into signings, because the manager's the person who has to put the player on the pitch, decide what slot they fit into, can they play the same formation. Data can help with that. I think data gets you 80% of the way there. It gets you from 1,000 potential signings to the 10 best options. And then that's where your sort of traditional scouting experts, that's where the manager and the sporting director come in, look at the finances, the character of the player, to really, and because you've sort of narrowed that down to 10 signings from 1,000, you can do a lot of work and put a lot of time in on those players. Whereas clubs that don't have that data approach, they're just looking at so many potential players that, you know, you only do a superficial job on each one.
Yeah, I think it's probably fair to say that David Pleat isn't massively on board with data. That felt like the kind of overall message from David last week. Ian, there's one line in the book where you talk about, like, not the importance of not signing players, that we obviously live in kind of a transfer culture, and a lot of fans, definitely journalists, assume that the solutions to any given problem are found in the transfer market. How much did you find at Liverpool, and how much do you find now that you're working with lots of different teams, that part of your job is saying, well, look, actually, this player that you've got in this position is probably the best you can do given what's out there?
Yeah, it's hard signing a player that's going to improve your team. Good players, you know, they're in demand. Everyone wants to sign a good player. when we started at Liverpool and we were finishing, you know, 8th and 7th in the league, it was easier. The squad wasn't world class at that time. And so there were players available that improved us. But as the team gets better and better, there are fewer and fewer players. You know, who's going to take Van Dijk's spot off him? Who's going to take Salah's spot off him? And we felt it was fine to spend money and fine to sign players, but those players have got to make a difference on the pitch. The worst thing you can do is sign, you know, a fourth or a fifth choice centre back who's probably not going to get on the pitch for you. You're just buying an insurance policy. And it's hard when you've got this transfer culture. I think when I was at Liverpool, we lost most of the transfer windows, but we were happy with that because on the pitch, we did the winning rather than in the transfer windows.
So I know one player that you did have a big hand in signing was Mo Salah. How does it work? Do you watch the player as well, or are you solely data-driven and then it's you pass it on to somebody else who then goes and watches the player? How does it work?
Yeah, so my department was entirely data-driven. We do watch video of players just so that we understand what we're seeing in the data is the same as the player that we're seeing on the pitch. But yeah, pure data approach. There are two facets to it. The first one is like, how good is this player? So we try and measure a team's chance of scoring and conceding a goal at any moment in the game. And then the player will interact with the ball. And then after the player's made a pass or made a run or done a tackle, team's chance of scoring or conceding a goal will change. How good the player is how much he's increased his team's chance of scoring or decreased the team's chance of conceding. But then next to that, there was trying to understand the role of the player. How did he fit into a formation? How did he interpret the role? So Salah's a winger or a wide forward, but he's a very different sort of winger to Andros Townsend or to Stuart Downing. They interpret the role in very different ways. And Mo ticked all of the boxes, so brilliant quality, but also would fit straight into a Jurgen Klopp 4-3-3 formation. And also he'd, you know, we didn't have any competition in the Premier League because of a lot of other teams had put a lot of weight on the fact that he'd failed at Chelsea. But going back to that signing players question, Chelsea had signed Mo Salah, but Hazard was the starting player in that position. So of course he's not going to start over Hazard.
So you talk about Salah. Was there, because of his experience with Chelsea, how much resistance was there on signing Salah because of those reasons? And how much did you have to push because of the data that you did compile?
Internally, zero. So I cared about the data more than about this failure at Chelsea. If there was a reason for the failure at Chelsea, you know, if they were having to play an academy player instead of Salah as a first choice player, then you can ask the question, why is he not getting on the pitch? But it was obvious he's not getting on the pitch because Hazard's one of the best players in the world. And then similarly, the sporting director didn't really care about public opinion. He just cared how good the player was. And from a character point of view, he believed that Mo had the character to become a superstar in the league. And Jurgen, to his credit, didn't really care about the noise. I think being German rather than being British helped with that. So he just cared about how good the player was. So Jurgen and Michael and the data all agreed the sort of outside noise about his failure at Chelsea and so on. We just didn't care about. I remember asking Michael, you know, surely, you know, he's so good. One of the big six in the Premier League is going to be in for him. And his opinion, which I think was right, was, yeah, they know he's a good player, but they don't want to look stupid in case they sign him and he doesn't work out because it didn't work out at Chelsea.
Could you quantify then, sort of percentage wise, you know, how much influence you have or had with all these dealings at Liverpool?
Yeah, for a numbers person, I'm loath to put an actual number on it. Mike Gordon.
Just your saying it and the influence you had. I do find this fascinating because I think it's a great debate because you can't measure through data somebody's character, which is a very big thing. You listen to a lot of top level managers, and they will talk about that. But just from your point of view,
so I mean, yeah, if you want to put a number on it, then if you go back to the Champions League final that we won in 2019, 9 of the 11 starters, data played a part in their arrival at Liverpool. And of those 9, Salah would have arrived anyway, Fabinho would have arrived anyway, Matip may not have arrived anyway, Robertson may not have arrived anyway, Alisson would have arrived anyway, Van Dijk would have. So the star players, and even the players who weren't stars like Salah and Mane, there was absolute agreement inside the club, these players are going to be great for us. It was the players where there were question marks. So Robertson had been relegated, Wijnaldum had been relegated. So there were question marks, similar to the question marks about Mo Salah. And
Andy Robertson, the question marks over him. You say he was relegated, but there were deficiencies in his game.
Yeah. So that's, so Robertson was a player who exceeded my expectations defensively. So Hull City, with Harry Maguire and Andy Robertson starting most of the games for them, got relegated, conceding the most goals in the Premier League that season. And Robertson was always a world-class attacking fullback, even when he was playing at Hull. But we were worried about his defending. It was difficult to analyse because they changed systems and changed managers, got promoted and relegated. So we try and adjust for all of those things through the data analysis, but it's difficult to do. And so Robertson was number 3 on our list of fullbacks to sign that summer. And, you know, by far the lowest transfer fee. I was excited about it because, you know, he was a data value for money signing. But I remember saying, I'm not sure about his defending. And it was Jürgen who said, I don't care what is defending. I want my fullbacks to attack. We can cover up for him with other positions if we're worried about his defending. So even though I'll claim Andy was a later signing, I was a bit reticent about it until Jürgen said, I understand your worries about him. We can cover that up. And to be fair to Robertson, he's become a much better defender than I thought he would be.
Overall, and we'll let you go back to Fleetwood Morecambe in a minute because you've given us a good 20 minutes, so thank you. But overall, were the models you were using, and obviously still are using when you consult for the different clubs, are they unique to you and devised by you and your company? What I'm trying to get at is whether it's the model or whether it's the interpretation of models that are available to a lot of people.
Yeah, it's both. So we've been doing it longer than anyone else, and it's kind of just demonstrated success. So I think we've got an edge when it comes to the quality of the model. But then, you know, you give some smart people access to some football data, they'll come up with similar ideas to each other. So interpretation is really important. It's really easy to do and really dangerous to misinterpret data. Mm. So going back 10 years, we had David Moyes and his 80 crosses against Fulham, for example, because crosses are a good way to score goals. The other thing that's really important is implementation. So at Liverpool, the decision makers listened to the data analysis. That was a missing piece at a lot of other clubs.
Sorry, just quickly. It was there one player who passed all your tests with flying colours and you were 100% sure was going to be an absolute success, but for one reason or another, didn't work out?
You weren't involved in Chris Sutton going to Birmingham, were you, back in the day?
I'm sure. I mean, you know, thankfully, it wasn't available back then. It's a difficult question. The answer is Naby Keita. He was my favourite player for many years in Austria and in Germany. I'd defend Naby and say he played as well at Liverpool as he had at Leipzig. He just suffered injury problems. And again, looking at the kind of fit of the player, he was a really risk-taking, forward-thinking midfielder. it's not always what the coaches wanted from our midfield.
Ian, now that you're kind of working away from that kind of vaguely golden period for data and implementation of it at Liverpool, how, like, are people listening? Are you, the fact that you're working with clubs makes it sound like, certainly at the executive level, clubs are kind of thinking this is something we need to do, and ideally thinking this is something we need to be better at. But is a lot of it still kind of, not, it's not quite virtue signalling, but they're just sort of box ticking and saying, right, we've got Ian Graham doing a bit of data for us, so we're a smart, modern, forward-thinking club, or our team's taking it seriously as one of the weapons in their arsenal?
Yeah, it's easy to do that box ticking exercise. The clubs I'm working with, they all came to me and expressed an interest, and they all are taking it seriously. And I think it's like a sign of how far our adaptation of data has come, that I can have discussions directly with head coaches about data and about recruitment policy in a way that 10 years ago just wouldn't have been accepted. I wouldn't have been accepted as having anything sensible to say about football. So yeah, there's still a way to go, but progress is being made.
Lots of room for people who don't say anything sensible about football to have careers, though, Ian. I find
it's a crowded market, unfortunately.
one final question then, and again, this comes from sort of reading some of the stuff you're talking about. The rise or the importance of models going forward that show how you can influence games, even if you're not on the ball. And where you and the spatially where you are on a pitch, so this is how it's developing all the time now.
Yeah, So a classic example of this, well, centre back is the position that it's traditionally been hardest to measure because so much of their game is off the ball positioning and holding the correct line and so on. But a great example of off-ball positioning is, your job as a striker is to continually try and make that diagonal run in behind, try and get a step on the centre-backs, waiting for the pass to come. The striker can keep on making those runs. If the pass is on but it doesn't come, the striker hasn't done anything, but you can see in the data where he's actually making valuable runs, that if there was a better midfielder to thread a ball to him, then he could make a difference for us that he's not currently making for the team he's at today.
Thank you very much for coming on. You've given us a bit longer than 50 minutes. It's still goalless, by the way, between Fleetwood and Morecambe, so I don't think you've missed anything. But thank you.
Yeah. I shall get back to it.
Yeah, get back to it. Good luck with the book. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, everyone.
Cheers, Ian. Thank you. Ian Graham with us on the Monday Night Club. Did you interview him for your book, Rory?
Hang on. Did I speak to Ian? I think, but I can't remember if it was off the record or on. Yes, I spoke to Ian for my book. He was actually, I was quite nervous about Ian's reaction to my book because he is, like he said, Liverpool are basically, along with Brighton and Brentford, Liverpool are the kind of proof of concept for data in football, because you need to win trophies for football to take you seriously. Brighton and Brentford are probably more advanced now in terms of like how much they use data than Liverpool. But Liverpool were the first big team to say, look, this is part of what we do and we're not going to hide it anymore. And so I kind of wanted to make sure that the history that I told sounded vaguely true to Ian. So I was quite nervous about kind of running stuff by him, but he was very helpful. I just can't remember if that's something I meant to tell people or not. But he's now got his own book and it's very good.
Did you copy anything from...
My book came out first, so no.
Oh, did it?
By like 2 years.
Well, you don't know. Okay, thanks for explaining it.
But yeah, I didn't, yeah, like, kind of, yeah.
What data about yourself, Andros, do you care about the most? Like, when you come off a field, when you come off a field, are you interested in your stats?
Not really. So I've, in terms of like assists, that's something that obviously I want to get assists, but it doesn't really interest me. For me, it's how many crosses I got in the box or how many successful crosses did I get in the box. And it's more stuff that I can control. Whereas like people are judged so much on assists, whereas there's so much somebody else has to do for you to get an assist. You could, one could come off your shin and hit someone else and go in and you get the assist. So for me, it was all about crosses and how many crosses, how many successful crosses, as opposed to just assists.
Well, there's another example of that. In fact, it goes back to a Wolves goal from the Wolves goal against Newcastle, where the cross came in and Ricardo Gomez dummied it, and Mario Lemina scored. And I don't think you get the assist for the dummy, but the only one, yeah, you should do, shouldn't you?
100%.
Do you, Rory, stat man? Do you, as the stat man here?
No, I think there's flaws in it like that. You have to touch it.
Yeah.
But that's
ridiculous. Yeah,
that's clearly not.
They don't understand the game.
Bless
that level of statistic is not what clubs are working with. I think the clubs will be looking at kind of the number of successful crosses Andros has put into the box, into the right area, the number of crosses he's completed, the number of dribbles he's made, working out kind of the work that he's done off the ball. But a lot of that isn't. You quite often hear players say, "We never talk about data." And it's used, and obviously I have a horse in this race, but it's used as proof that data hasn't infused football. But if you speak to the people on the data side, the idea is that the players should not, the players don't need to know the kind of the whys and the wherefores of the algorithms they're using. It's not relevant. It's the bulk of it is still used in recruitment because that's where teams spend their money. But I think in terms of even the way it influences the actual way the game is played, it goes to the coach, and the coach then incorporates the bits that they find useful in training. No one's in there saying footballers need to have a kind of hour and a half math lesson every week because it's not an effective way of getting the information across, and they don't need to know it. So I think a lot of it is kind of used to find things out, to pick out certain bits that are useful, and then that is then diffused to the players through training. That's kind of how it is used, I think.
Okay.
Alan Thompson, can you remember Alan Thompson?
Yeah,
when we used to have the old Carling Opta stats back in the day, it was all about running stats. So you know who would do the most sprints and run the most. So he used to run when the opposition had a throw in, a weirder throw, and just to get his stats up, which is genius.
Well,
the only stats Andros is interested in looking at him this evening is how big his biceps are.
Let's talk about a player then. Let's talk about a Liverpool player, Trent Alexander-Arnold. 100 days now until he can negotiate a contract with foreign clubs and leave Anfield for nothing in the summer. So here he is on his future.
I think the most important thing is trophies, if I'm honest. I want to win trophies. I'm a player who's highly motivated by trophies and winning things and being elite. So that's probably the main factor of anything. We were close to the title last season. The quad was on for a while, I suppose. So signs are there. This season we're looking really good. It's still early days, but we need to have a lot of consistency and beat a lot of teams over the course of the season. I want the captain of the club. That's a name of mine. That's a goal of mine. Look, I've been at the club 20 years now. I've signed 4 or 5 contract extensions, and none of those have been played out in public, and this one won't be it either.
What do you make of that, Chris Sutton?
Oh, I can't believe that he's actually in this position where his contract is running down as it is. That's my my gut feeling. Why would it get to here from his perspective? He's in a brilliant position, I suppose. New manager coming in on the slot, he can work under him and judge whether he's really enjoying it, how the team is progressing, and make a decision off the back of that. But he must have had his head turned somewhere. But I suppose a lot depends on how he sees Liverpool performing this season and whether they're going to be a major challengers again.
He said over the weekend, Andros, "I said to the manager, I'd like to be the defender that no one wants to come up against in Europe. We agreed that he'll be harsh on me. If any time an attacker gets past me, he'll call it out in team meetings and individual meetings and say, this cannot happen. We go through every game together and he highlights where he wants me to improve. Even in the Milan game, we had about 20 clips going through what I could have done better and the good parts as well. Defences win championships, that's the old saying, and being part of that defence means I have responsibilities to make sure my winger doesn't get a sniff." What is he like to come up against?
I've never been on his side. I've never come up against him personally, but I think he's somebody who is a good one-on-one defender. People talk about, oh, he can't defend, but he can defend. It's just that his role in the Liverpool team is more focused on what he does going forward. So maybe at times he's caught out, well, people perceive that he's caught out of position where it's somebody else's job. It's maybe a Henderson or Fabinho's job to cover him when he gets forward. But people see Trent high up the pitch and the winger running through and think Trent can't defend. But actually, one-on-one, he's actually a very competent defender.
Well, interestingly, Ian Graham has just kind of backed that up, hasn't he, Rory, with the Andy Robertson discussion. And Jurgen Klopp saying, look, if they're good going forward, that's what I want. We can cover the defensive side elsewhere. Now, that was in the discussion about Andy Robertson, but you would assume that there was an element of that in what he expected from Alexander-Arnold.
Yeah, no, I've got to admit, I've always found the debate about Trent's defending totally baffling. I don't understand it. I don't understand how anyone's watching football and thinking he's a terrible defender. Like Andros just summed it up perfectly. Trent Alexander-Arnold gets caught out of position. For those watching on the iPlayer, I'm doing the inverted quotes thing, because he's not meant to be standing on the edge of his 18-yard box being a right back from the 1970s. That's not his job. His job is to kind of drift forward and be a midfielder.
That's not everything. That's not been everything. And I know where you're going with this, and I sort of agree, but there are also pecking orders, and people naturally, when they're at the highest level, they are compared. So if you were to say, is Trent as good a defender as Kyle Walker in 1v1 situations? The answer would be no. That's not a criticism.
No, but that's not, Chris.
That's where he's judged at international level, etc.
No. That is. I agree with you with that sentiment completely. Trent Alexander-Arnold not as good defensively as Kyle Walker in one-on-one situations. Kyle Walker not as good at creating chances and scoring goals as Trent Alexander-Arnold. The difference, I think, is that debate, which is perfectly valid, has kind of bled into, you can't play Alexander-Arnold, he can't defend. That is the way it's presented in public. And that, to me, I mean, he shut Rafael Leão down in Milan on whatever night it was. And the other thing that I find really baffling, and this, I don't know what Andros's view on this is, sometimes wingers beat their fullback. That's allowed to happen. It doesn't make them bad defenders. You see all these compilation videos now of, it's not just Alexander-Arnold, it's lots of fullbacks being kind of owned by wingers. But you think, well, yeah, sometimes the guy with the ball gets past them. It's not a failure just because you're beaten in a dribble once a game. It doesn't mean you've had a sort of a nightmare and should retire. And Trent Alexander-Arnold is not the world. He's not a right-footed Paolo Maldini, but he's not in the team to be Paolo Maldini. And what he adds to that team is clearly worth more to Liverpool than like having a slightly more than having Kyle Walker there, for example. So I find the debate really odd. It's to Trent's credit that he wants to improve defending. I'm inclined to agree with Chris that it's a very strange situation that his contract has 9 months to run.
Andros, on the winger beating a fullback, it is allowed to happen.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's because the social media generation have this narrative that Trent can't defend. They're just waiting for that one moment in the game where he does get taken on by his winger. That may happen 10, 15 times a season, 20 times a season, and they just put it into one compilation and all of a sudden it's Trent can't defend. Whereas Rory's exactly right. It's not wingers beat their fullback. Wingers make their fullback look silly at times. It's always going to happen.
What do you think he'll do in the summer, Chris?
I think he will go to Real Madrid.
Dear.
Well, you just asked me, I've answered. Are you questioning it? I mean,
oh, God. I don't know.
I don't know what more I can give.
Okay. Is there any reason why you think that?
Well, from everything which I've seen and read, there's a reason why he's running his contract down. And, you know, he sort of has to defend himself and say, well, he's, you know, his contracts previous to this have been done in private, and that's the way I you know have handled things in the past. But it it's unusual for a club of Liverpool's size, what he's done there, for him to be in the last 9 months of his contract. It's different with Van Dijk and Salah because they're older. They're in the 30s. With Trent Alexander-Arnold, this shouldn't be happening. It is happening. And how many clubs out there are bigger than Real Madrid, or where could he naturally go to? And it will be Real Madrid, so we can clip this up in a few months' time and play this.
I don't think he necessarily wants to leave Liverpool or is searching to leave Liverpool, but Real Madrid is Real Madrid. If there is interest from Real Madrid, I don't think as a player you can turn that down. He's won the Premier League, he's won the Champions League, he's won a lot at Liverpool. You can't really say no. I'm using Real Madrid a lot, but you can't really say no to Real Madrid.
But I think it's valid to use Real Madrid as the example because I'm not sure. Well, there's three teams in Europe that could pay his wages, and that's Real, Bayern and PSG. And I think the only one that would maybe tempt him to leave Liverpool is Real Madrid. I don't think either of the others would be particularly compelling enough in his, playing for his hometown club, having already won a Premier League, having already won a Champions League. I think the only one that turns your head is Real, where your very good friend Jude Bellingham also happens to play.
Quickly, how did the fan base react to that, Rory? Jamie Carragher was saying something this week, I think, or last week, that it'd be quite interesting how fans react to... They'll have different reactions to Van Dijk and Salah going compared to Alexander-Arnold going.
Yeah, I think so, because he's a Scouser, because he's a local kid. I think it depends how it's framed, to an extent. If he were to go... I'm not sure... Michael Owen obviously went to Real Madrid from Liverpool. Probably fair to say he's not a universally loved figure at Anfield. I think Steve McManaman kind of wore it relatively well. I don't remember him being kind of branded a traitor, particularly for running his contract down and going to Real. I think Liverpool, I think football fans understand on some level, once the emotion sort of subsides, that, yeah, it's Real Madrid, it's a chance to do something different, to play for this huge institution. It might not make him popular, but I suspect it wouldn't do any lasting damage.
Fred sends us an email. If Alexander-Arnold wants to win trophies... If Alexander-Arnold wants to win trophies, he should sign for Celtic, then spend the rest of the time droning on about it. I don't know who that is.
You just made that up. There's no way somebody... That's a disgrace.
That's on my... It's on my screen. And if I get Fred's email address, I'm going to reply to him, Chris, and say, do you mind? A bit of respect. He saved Scottish football. On to talking about Everton. The Friedkin Group has today reached an agreement to buy Fahad Mashiri's majority 94% stake in Everton. Now, the deal is subject to regulatory approval from the Premier League, the FA, and the Financial Conduct Authority. They had agreed the deal in principle back in June, but then walked away from negotiations when they were unable to complete the deal. So let's bring in Julia Bold from BBC Radio Merseyside. Are Everton fans at a stage where they can get excited about this, or... have we been here before with other people a few times?
Yeah, there's a phrase, isn't there? Everton that. So, yeah, a lot of people are a bit worried tonight about this. But I actually feel there's a real sense of positivity speaking to fans this afternoon as this news started to come out. It feels like, dare I say, this might be the one that's going to go through. So, yeah, as it stands, the deal is done. I'm told it is signed. The finances are in place. The due diligence was actually done in June. So that was when the Friedkin Group had exclusivity, and then they walked away after that exclusivity period. So the due diligence had already been done. So all that needs to be done now is the Premier League to approve all of this takeover. But, yeah, it certainly feels like... Everton fans are happier tonight, I dare say. There is a little bit of them, though, that keep thinking, is this really going to happen? Is there going to be a change? And, yeah, I think the end of the Mashiri tenure at Everton is now happening.
What? Why did they walk away last time?
It was to do with a loan that was put into Everton by 777. Now, they were another group that tried to take over at Everton. So they were a Miami-based consortium. They got exclusivity a year ago. And missed several deadlines. The last deadline was the start of June this year, but they'd already put money in. There's been legal cases around 777 as to who they owe money to. And the Friedkin Group in June felt that there were just too many issues around that. I am told today that those issues have been resolved now, and this moved really quickly over the last couple of days.
What would this mean for Everton? Is it a case of keeping the lights on, putting out some fires, maybe they can finish their stadium? Or does this put them into like a more Newcastle where there is money available if they can get round the PSR nonsense that they have now?
Yeah, I think at the moment it's too early to say what the Friedkin Group will do, because they've just said right now that they're going to bring stability to the club, which, as you know, Andros, stability is something Everton has been crying out for a long time. I'm sure in the longer term, that's what fans would like to see. Yeah, maybe something like equivalent of a Newcastle, what's happened there. Right now, though, the stadium on Liverpool's waterfront, Bramley Moor Dock, is due to open next season. So Everton are finishing their season this time at Goodison. We are told that anything that needs finishing, the Friedkin Group will move Everton over. That will be their stadium as well. Yeah, it means, hopefully, more financial stability for Everton, which has been a real problem. And as you know, Andros, again, there's been players sold off over recent years because of PSR situations and in order to keep the club functioning. So hopefully, this means much more financial stability.
Do we know whether the Friedkin group are a fan of Sean Dyche or not?
Yeah, they're very different. That's come from the John Textor interview, I would imagine. Now, John Textor, of course, is Crystal Palace co-owner. He was very interested, but he never had exclusivity because, as everybody knows, you can't own two Premier League clubs at the time. So while he was in talks with Farhad Moshiri, he couldn't push that deal through. And I know he gave an interview saying that, you know, he'd been talking about Sean Dyche players he might bring in for Sean Dyche, even though the deal was nowhere near. The Friedkin Group operate rather differently. They don't tend to do interviews. Dan Friedkin doesn't put himself in front of the cameras. I'm sure once this is all ratified, and I'm told it could happen in a matter of weeks, that would be the very first question. But right now, I'm sure poor Sean Dyche is going to be at another press conference this week on Thursday, being asked about things he doesn't know anything about.
They are also the owners of Roma. And in June, when it looked first time round like they were going to buy Everton, Dan Friedkin said he wanted Roma and Everton to sit at the top of a multi-club model. Rory, how have they run Roma?
They've been okay. I mean, the big issue with Roma is that you need to build a new stadium, and to build a new stadium, you need to get around Italian bureaucracy. And lots of people have tried that. And the Friedkins, I think they've got plans out currently for a new stadium in Rome, which looks amazing. Quite how many decades it will take to actually build it, very difficult to say. They've been a little bit up and down. They've tried various coaches. They've had kind of good years and bad years. The one thing, they've employed some really smart people. But the one thing, I suppose, from the outside is I'm not convinced they've got like an overarching football strategy that they've shown at Roma. They're not incompetent by any means. I think if the Friedkins buy Everton, that is extremely good news for Everton fans. That is stability. It's, you know, smart, competent, sensible people in charge. They've had a bit of a rocky week. They sacked Daniele De Rossi and then the chief executive quit on Sunday, I think. But generally, they've been okay at Roma.
So it's not going well at the moment for them there, then, really.
You're not painting a great picture, Corey, are you?
No, but it's not. It wouldn't be fair.
That was a great answer until the last 5 seconds for Everton fans, and then it just sounded, oh, my God.
Sometimes football clubs have bad points of the season, and Roma just happen to be in one right now. The two things, I think generally if the Friedkins get it, it's given where Everton were, and Julia mentions the kind of actual like existential threat that Everton have been under, the Friedkins are a good thing. The two things that would maybe you'd want to know would be kind of what their actual vision of what they want the club to be is. I'm not sure what they've done at Roma really makes that clear. And the other is kind of whether you can have twin head to a multi-club network, because I'm not convinced that you can.
No, and that would be the final thing I was going to say to you, Julia, really, is that whilst Everton fans will want this and the stability, you probably eventually want to be the number one club in a multi-club model, don't you?
Yeah, and I would imagine he's already described Everton as a sleeping giant, so he certainly sees Everton as the jewel maybe in his crown, and the Premier League, I think, tag would come along with that. So there's a lot of Roma fans, you know, bizarrely, there's a lot of AS Roma Everton fans, if there is such a thing, can you believe? But I've managed to find some, and their major concern as for Roma is that they think that that will be second fiddle now, because Everton is going to come first for the freaking group, because it is a Premier League side. It's got a brand new stadium, pretty much ready to go, and that they will have all these achievements set out for Everton, whereas Roma might become now the poor relation.
Julia, thank you very much for being with us. A positive Everton chat on the Monday Night Club for once with you. Thank you. Julia Bold with us on the Monday Night Club. Let's talk Nicholas Jackson next. Doubled his goal tally for the season at the weekend. Scored two in Chelsea's win at West Ham. Four in five Premier League appearances this season. Has he changed? Have the team changed to accommodate him? Is he just growing as a striker, Chris Sutton?
Well, with all the mayhem going on at Chelsea last season, I actually thought he came out with great credit. I think he was signed initially as a development player. I may be wrong with that, but I think he got enough game time, maybe because of Nkunku's injury last season, where he got a run of games, and his goal tally was all right last season. I think he got 17 in all competitions. I think that there are certainly parts of his game which he needs to improve. But I think the type of player he is, and I think he's a player where he has excellent movement in behind. He has that pace. It's all about the timing of his runs, and he stretches defences with the players that Chelsea have in their team, the likes of Cole Palmer. He's a really good fit, because they get on the ball, he makes the movements, and they find him. So to have that type of striker, and the way that his confidence seems to have grown, and he started the season well, that bodes well for Chelsea. And there's always this debate, Mark, about Chelsea need a number nine. Maybe, just maybe, they don't.
And probably shouldn't underestimate Cole Palmer's influence in this, Andros, as Chris has said. Palmer and Jackson combined for 10 Premier League goals since the start of last season, which is at least two more than any other combination.
Yeah. Yeah, and he's got Enzo, who's playing a bit higher up as well. But I think even last season, watching Nicholas Jackson, he had everything but the goal. So he had the movement, he had the dribbling, he was getting into some great positions, but he just wasn't finishing them off. But especially the goals he scored on the weekend, they were competently taken. They were confidently taken, and like an expert striker. And that's, we weren't seeing that last season. So maybe the early goals have done him the world of good. And now we're going to see this player who's going to be clinical when he gets chances in front of goal.
I thought the second one, Andros, in particular, was such a good run and fit. I mean, Denver Barr has put it on social media going, it's a masterclass in creating space. How he gets the defender out of position and then gets in there is top level, even better than the finishing itself.
I think that the matchup was a mismatch, because West Ham were going man for man all over the pitch, and they left Jackson, Mavropanos, I think he was, isolated with Nicholas Jackson. And it was just a matchup that was never going to work. And yeah, the way he found space, dragged the man out of position, then went in behind. Sorry, my phone just dropped. Went in behind, was brilliant. And he slotted it home as
what
well.
Did but, it yeah, drop? He what did it every... drop into? A steel drum?
You don't want to know my setup at the minute. We haven't got enough time to explain my setup, but... Yeah.
Oh my word. Anyhow, Rory, Nicholas Jackson.
Yeah, I think in a way it's quite a heartening story, isn't it? Because there was a lot of criticism for Jackson last year, and that probably too much to say he was a laughing stock at any point, but there was a sense of, well, he's just kind of another random player Chelsea have signed. But he's worked at it, and I think he's benefited. You mentioned Enzo playing a bit further forward, and obviously Palmer's form. But Chelsea seems somehow, and it's to Maresta's enormous credit, he, for all the chaos on the outside and the bomb squads and the players being forced out and all that stuff, he seems to have got that core group and fashioned a pretty tight unit from it. And they look more than they have for a long time. They look like a unified side with an actual style of play and a purpose. And I agree, like West Ham weren't very good, but Chelsea took them apart pretty immaculately.
Has he done the right thing then, Andros, in going, these are the players, there's no uncertainty here. Now the players who were left out or moved on or made to train with the under 20, whatever it was, they may feel aggrieved. But actually, from the certainty point of view, from going, right, these are the ones I'm going to work with, these are the only ones I can work with, I can't work with 45 players, I need to work with 22 or whatever it is, right, and tough. At least you all know where you stand, I suppose.
Yeah. I think he probably could have done it in a better way, but he has to do that. You can't, it's impossible to train with 30 players and be able to have a proper session and get your ideas across as a new manager. It's just, I've seen it time and time before. It just doesn't work.
What was his alternative, Andros? How could he have done that in another way, really?
Well, I think in terms of coming out publicly and saying that, my opinion is he could have been a bit more sensitive to players who have done well for the club in the past. No?
But it's just, that's the game, isn't it? As long as players know where they stand, I think that they can handle it. I would always much rather people be straight with you in those situations. And to be fair to Maresca, he was straight.
He is.
I think to
go on, Andros.
Go on. I think the players' face, but I think especially with Raheem Sterling and Chilwell, I think it was, to come out publicly and say they need to. I don't know. It's just the way he said it. Maybe I'm being a bit of a snowflake, and maybe I'm part of the problem, the new generation. But yeah, I just think that it probably something like that should be done behind closed doors as opposed to in public.
I think it was also the
point of trimming down his squad. Yeah,
it was also quite a strange business decision. I think that's the way to kind of protect yourself from accusations that you're being a snowflake. Like to say, we've got these two players who are on, 170, 200 grand a week. We don't want them anymore. Come and get them. That doesn't make a huge amount of sense from a business point of view. And I think he probably was maybe forced into that position because it was getting so late in the window. They kept signing players. I'm not sure it was him who was signing players, but they kept bringing these players in. And he was thinking, well, I need some of these people to leave. Like they just have to. So maybe he was more brutal than he would like to, than he would ordinarily have been because of the desperation of the situation. But I think generally he did have to find that core group and start naming a consistent team. Because one of the problems with Chelsea last year was that, like, Mudrick would have a bad game, so they put Sterling on, but then Sterling would have a bad game, so they play somebody else, and then play some. And it was just, there was this endless kind of choice, and after a while, presumably that stops you actually finding any momentum, any rhythm, any familiarity.
They, I heard tonight that Chilwell was maybe coming back into the fold. Just
I think he's training with the first team, yeah.
Could they finish fourth for you, Chris, or is it too early?
Well, they could do. It's very early to judge, Mark. I mean, I'm the BBC predictions expert. I've lost every round this season, but I'm not
you?
So sure.
Have you lost every single week?
I think so.
Right.
Yeah, I think so.
Wow. Yeah. Are you doing silly ones or are you trying to be realistic?
I don't think they're silly. I'm doing my best. I'm just having a bad run. It's just my life the last couple of months.
Are you going full Paul Merson?
No, not that full.
Chris, which of your children are you outsourcing this part of your job to? Does it, obviously, one of your sons does the fantasy for you. Are you getting, is Sophia doing
I'm
doing
having a disaster in... I'm having a disaster in fantasy football as right. well. Like I could tell you a lot about that, but I won't. We haven't got time.
But and I don't have the interest.
No, save that for the hugely successful podcast that you do on fantasy football. Just before we go, Andros, are you fully settled now? Are you registered and playing and all going okay?
It's all going well. I'm registered now. I'm off the beach, unfortunately, and I've played two games already. So yeah, all the uncertainty a few weeks ago is now put to bed, and I can get back to playing football and doing a Monday Night Club.
Was it? I mean, it must have been a worrying spell, not knowing, you know, whether you were registered, how it was all going to pan out. Last time we spoke to you, you were over there, but you were in a sort of limbo, weren't you?
Yeah, it was a bit worrying, especially when you were getting told, like I said, it was going to get done tomorrow, that was kind of like, oh, is it going to get to deadline day? And they're going to be like, sorry, we can't do it. You're going to have to either go or you're not going to play for 6 months. And that was my biggest worry. But yeah, thankfully, I think that it was one player that they had to pay 3 years of his contract, which obviously they didn't want to do, but they had to settle it to get me registered, and they managed to do it.
You're unbeaten in the two matches you played so far, and you get Mourinho's Fenerbahce this weekend. Is that at home or away?
That's at home.
Right.
But I'm told that's going to be. Yeah. So for a normal game, we get 9,000 at home in a 30,000 seat stadium. But I'm told when the big boys come to town, it's like it's full turkey experience, it's full sellout crowd, and yeah, flares the lot.
You must be looking forward to it, because this will be like nothing you've experienced then.
No, yeah, absolutely not. I remember playing a Greek side, PAOK, in the Europa League, and it was mental. Like, I mean, like walking out to look at the pitch an hour and a half before kickoff, and everyone was in the stadium. There were flares, they were whistling. It was, I can't wait to experience that again, but as a home team player. So, yeah, we watched a derby in a hotel, Fenerbahce, Galatasaray, on the weekend, which was, as you can imagine, it was a fiery encounter. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to playing Jose Mourinho's Fener.
Finished Fenerbahce 1, Galatasaray 3 that, and afterwards Galatasaray dubbed Mourinho the crying one because he left without doing a match press conference. You're going to have a lot of fun, aren't you? Andros, thank you very much. Rory as well, and Chris, we will do it all again next week. Thank you for listening and watching. 7 o'clock next Monday, we will be back. Next up on 5 Live Sport, we'll do 5 Live Boxing after Jill McKenzie.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Lebanon says Israeli airstrikes are now known to have killed more than 350 people. 1,200 are said to have been injured. It's the deadliest day of conflict across Israel's northern border in nearly two decades. The Lebanese health minister is Firas Aviad.
Our understanding is that there has been over 500 airstrikes in different locations, whether in southern Lebanon, in Bika, and also in other areas. The vast majority, if not all, of the sites that were targeted were civilian. Some of them were residential buildings. And we had this number of casualties really mounting very fast.
Speaking in the last hour, the Israeli Defense Force spokesperson, Daniel Hagari, said the fighting would continue until Israel believed its citizens in the north of the country were safe from attack.
We are not looking for wars. We are looking to take down the threats. And there will not be a 7th of October threat in the northern border. It have to be a safe border where Hezbollah is pushed back from the border and there are no threats like missiles, rockets, UAV, threatening our communities, our citizens.
Rachel Reeves says there'll be no return to austerity. In her first speech to a Labour Party conference as Chancellor,